Chapter 17 of Green Grey Homestead by Steele Rudd. This legamous recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Read by Anna Simon. You left the ploughing to canter to the railway station to order a wheat truck. You have just returned, and it's getting dusk. You have been trying Newton's paces along the lane, and, warmed up, his eyeballs are dilating, and he's looking his noblest. "What did you think of her, old horsey?" you'll question like a big kid, patting him on the neck as you pull the bridle off. "Wouldn't you like to be me? Wouldn't you, if you was a man? Don't I know you would?" Only the Lord can tell whether the horse understands or not, but as he swings round to roll in the dust, he'll nicker as if he did. Later, seated at table over the steak you fried, you'll take Rover into your confidence. You'll talk to him while he sits on his tail, listening. When you fall into silence, he'll whimper and bark. "You ain't met her yet," you'll tell him. "But if you'd been with me this evening, you would, you old scoundrel. I met her near the railway, and I'm going to her place on Sunday." "You're not. No matter who's there, I'm to go. And I'm not to mind what Papa thinks. How would you like to be me, Rover? Wouldn't you sooner be me than the city dope who was trying to mash her at the picnic, looking as if he had just finished a term of epidemics? Cripes, wouldn't anyone?" But proud as you are of yourself, you are feeling shaky and nervous when Sunday arrives. Being favoured by Josie King will be one thing. Bracing up to go and see her in her home when you know her old man hasn't a spark of approbation in his make-up for you, and has developed a habit of reading you like a criminal lawyer, will be quite another thing. Still, you're facing it for her. And while you're getting ready, fastening your collar and tie, looking at yourself in the little mirror while your horse is hanging up outside, you'll be building castles in the air, castles in comparison with which Solomon's mansion, built with the help of 70,000 hewing wood for it in the mountains, and 3,600 overseeing, will be only a modest shack. So, closing the door behind you, you'll approach your horse, pulling your head down in front, pushing it up behind to please your fancy. Then into the saddle and off like a dispatch-bearer you'll rattle. It's a wonderful day, the sky pale blue, the air clear, the hills and valleys green, the wildflowers blooming, everything gay and glittering, nothing dull or brown or withering, not even the old rail fences or the dead timber. Full of secret hopes, you'll tear along the lanes as if you had all the angels with you. Coming in sight of the meadows, you'll steady the pace and get back to earth again. A procession of thoughts will run through your head that will make you uncomfortable. You'll start asking yourself, should you really go or not? Will Josie be at home? If you don't see her about, what you'll say to him? Drawing nearer the farmyard, you'll hear the windmill pumping, and you'll be getting the most out of your eyesight. To the left, on the white veranda of the home, there'll be a host of people lounging in squatters' chairs and hammocks. They're visitors, most of them women. How in the name of anyone can you be expected to dismount and mingle with that lot? Josie must have gone mad. You don't know the way to the front of the house. When you worked for old Silas years ago, you never got any further than the kitchen, and you don't want to go any further now. They're turning their heads, gawking, wondering who you are. What are you going to do now? Instead of Newcham wheeling and bolting off with you, he keeps stepping out briskly, tossing his head, snatching the bit, showing how glad he feels. You grind your teeth and screw up your courage as you open the gate and enter the yard. A tribe of dogs rush to meet and serenade you. Being the Sabbath, which old Silas King is careful to see kept sacred at the meadows since he has become prosperous and religious, the farmhands will be sitting about in the shade. You'll pass a cold knot to them, ride on to the stable, ducking your head under a clothesline to keep clear of a row of uninhabited things. Putting the horse away, you glance round the gravelled path leading to the front veranda. You'll reproach yourself for being a darn fool, and you feel that your hour is at hand, and you've been betrayed into the hands of the enemy. "Unless I'm blind, it's Dick Gall." You'll look round and be confronted by Bill Buck, the handyman of the meadows. He's shuffling solemnly towards you, looking as if he was under instructions to eject you. But when he asks, "Who is it you want to see, Mr. King?" and informs you that the boss never sees anyone about business on Sunday, you'll start beating about the bush. And when you've made yourself feel a fraud and a liar, and Bill can't make head or tail of you, Josie'll come tripping across the yard, looking like a fairy in her white silks, her hair waving in the wind, to save you. "Oh, you did come, Richard." She doesn't call you Dick, and she'll smile with her eyes and lips and teeth. "I was beginning to wonder if you really would." At that, Bill will touch his hat and make off. And while you're colouring up and gathering yourself together, Josie'll give a little laugh and invite you to the front veranda. You go off with her like a big pet stupid sheep being led to slaughter. "We've some visitors," she'll tell you, looking up curiously into your face. "But they're only Mr. and Mrs. Andrew Craig, Miss Fairfield and her sister and two friends, and Mr. Draper, a friend of Pa's, and a few others."
"Mr. Draper?" you mumble, as if the name was poison, with the same effect that strychnine would have on you.
"He's talking to Pa."
And this time Josie will touch your arm and look up at you in such a way that, instead of tasting strychnine, you'll feel you've taken champagne. Gee, you're a new man in an instant. She's inspired you. Instead of a sheep, you're a lion being led to the wolves by a dove. You're walking firm, erect, bold. Such a feeling never came over you before. Out of the slough of your humbleness, she's exalted you to a pedestal of bravery. You mount the veranda step for step with her. You're laughing with her. You're taking your hat off, smoothing your hair out of your eyes, and looking like a party leader taking the platform. Old Silas and Draper and the others are gaping at you. In a voice of gladness, Josie introduces you first to one, then to another, as "Mr. Richard Gall." Even to Pa, who, if you had darkened the sun and caused stars and hail to fall on the lawn, couldn't look more surprised. She's determined to make you known. Extending your hand to old Silas, you'll grip his limp fist and shake it heartily, inquiring after his health and expressing pleasure at his robust appearance. You'll greet the swell Draper in the same jovial spirit, recalling that you saw him at the school picnic. Then, displaying all the manners you know, you weren't always a lone, motherless homesteader, you'll bow and smile to the ladies, stoop gracefully to restore to Mrs. Craig a book that has fallen from her lap to the floor, and remain standing till Josie is seated. Putting you out of his mind, old Silas will sulkily continue the conversation. He'll address his remarks to Draper and the ladies, to everyone but you. You'll listen respectfully to their views, waiting the opportunity to express your own. Catching Josie's eye, you'll clear your throat and observe to old Silas,
"Just so, Mr. King, but always making the man with the most money top dog doesn't get the world anywhere. It is the greatest man who should be the servants of the others."
"What?" old Silas will frown on you.
"Servants of the others," Mr. Draper will sneer, looking meaningly at everyone but you.
"That's what Christ was," Josie will say, and beam on you.
"Christ? How dare you, girl?"
Pa will explode.
"I really think it's time to go," Mr. Draper will rise to his feet.
"We must be moving, too," from the others.
"And gold, too,"
Pa will growl towards Josie. Josie's eyes will flash.
"Richard is staying, Pa," she'll say,
and you will look sheepish while the others disperse. The flush will still be in your cheeks, and in Josie's too, and she'll be holding out a plate inviting you to a ginger nut, when old Silas will return. It'll be plain what he's returned for. There's no polish about Silas. He's blunt and proud and ignorant.
"Are you coming here to see my daughter, Gall?"
And he'll stare at you with unfriendly eyes. Seeing you're speechless, Josie will rebuke him with,
"Pa!"
"I don't know who you are," Silas will say, ignoring Josie. "You worked for me years ago at odd jobs, like lots of others, but that didn't make you a friend of mine, or of my family's. I don't know you, or where you're from, or anything about you."
With the colour deepening her cheek, and her eyes flashing more and more, Josie will look a picture. And though you don't feel quite yourself, you're not afraid, but you're thinking hard. "You might fancy you don't know me, Mr. King," you'll tell him in a quiet way. "But you knew my father once. You worked for him when he owned Borrowdale Downs."
"You a son of Donald Gaul's? A son of his?"
That's all old Silas will be able to articulate or even think for a second or two, for he'll be on the verge of emotion. Then, calling to the others to come here, he'll introduce you proudly as the son of Donald Gaul, the squatter, who took up Borrowdale Downs in the '60s and was the first to bring Clydesdales to this country, and an old friend of his. And then you'll know you're set. End of chapter 17.